Birds, bees, and butterflies wander far and wide to find home. Other animals put considerable effort into building nests and dens and protecting house and home and territory. And humans also cherish home, don't we? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We will talk about the pull of home and the homing instinct that exists with all species. And we will welcome your questions for our guest. We will welcome your own stories of home. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. We'll talk about the desire for homecoming that seems to exist across all species. What pulls humans toward a particular place, and how is it related to animal homing, and what might we learn from animal homing or migration? Let me welcome our guest. Very happy to have with us Bern Heinrich, Professor Emeritus in the Biology Department at the University of Vermont, the author of a number of books about nature writing, behavior, biology, ecology, and evolution. His most recent book is The Homing Instinct, Meaning and Mystery in Animal Migration. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
Thank you so much for being with us. So what do you mean in the title of the book, The Homing Instinct?
Well, what I'm talking about is the deeply ingrained in a biology, animal biology, the concept of home. But I guess the homing instinct is perhaps a misnomer because it involves many instincts, innumerable instincts of navigation, of having the urge to go home and having a home. And making home, so there are many instincts involved, and but they all relate to the same thing, to home, which is where the animal or we grew up, and where obviously it had been successful to live, and so that's what draws us back from the ancient roots of that concept.
Yeah, so I might have an urge to go home, but it's not so much a biological instinct?
Well, yeah, I think it definitely related to biological instinct, yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it is. A human being has an instinct to go home as well.
There are, of course, the proximate reasons. We want to go home to pick up the kids or whatever. But I'm talking about the emotional drives. For example, I'm back home now where I grew up, and many people have told me they have felt the same. They grew up in a certain place, and then they wandered all over the place, and eventually they like to come back. That something draws them back. I think that's related to our deep roots, to our instinctive passions.
I see. And you mentioned that you're in Vermont, and you could hunt right from your front porch, but you would rather, you are drawn to going back to the boyhood woods in Maine where you hunted.
Well, I'm actually in Maine where I grew up, and I was talking about my nephew Charlie, who grew up here too, and who is now in Pennsylvania, and who can shoot deer any time. But it's I did talk about hunting, but in the sense of being rooted in a home. It's a mechanism of connecting to the home, and he comes here every fall to be here. So it's a way of connecting to where we come from. And to him, it's an annual migration.
Well, in fact, I might have got ahead of myself. I did the pull of home is something that I do want to talk more about for humans. But let's talk about the migration.
Okay.
Why do animals migrate in the first place?
Well, if we look at birds, I mean, maybe the most potentially obvious way of seeing it is that they migrate, you know, obviously for the most part north and south. And so in the spring and the summer, you know, a huge habitat opens up, huge resources are suddenly available. And so half the world is now, you know, stocked with food. And those animals who could come up there and take advantage of it would have a huge advantage, right? But in the wintertime, it's extremely difficult, and so they have to leave. So this is then handled, being able to utilize these resources by being able to move back and forth between good habitats.
But migration is not solely for the purpose of avoiding a harsh winter or following food sources. Are there other reasons species have for moving from place to place?
Well, that's just about the main one, I would say. It's all about finding the right place. The right place to be, and at times it's not the right place, and you have to leave. And migration has evolved there, where it's regular, where it's predictable, where the weather patterns are predictable, and you know when this happens, then that's going to happen, or you know you have evolved to sense it, and you fly, travel back and forth. You know, in Africa, the plains animals, they migrate between, you know, where the grass grows after the rains, and then they move out when it's gone, and they come back again at a predictable time. And the same with caribou migrations, and on a smaller scale, it relates to just about everything. The butterflies, the monarch butterflies. So it's basically we call home, I would say, primarily where the young are produced, where the young are raised. But it does. You could also say, for example, that some of the birds who fly from North America down to Central and South America, they have basically a winter home. They go to very specific spots. Sometimes the same little acre that they have known, and they go back there. They don't reproduce there, but they go there to overwinter. So, you know, arguably you can say this is summer home, but basically home is related to where the animals reproduce.
So how do bees or butterflies or birds find their way back home from their winter feeding grounds or other territory?
Yeah. Well, of course, I did talk about homing in bees, and there I was talking about the mechanism of homing just between where they find food and the nest. So for a bee, it's a potentially very formidable task to go 10 kilometers to get nectar and pollen from flowers and to find the nest and get back. So that is the homing mechanism here is involved, and we're trying to find out how they actually manage that. When we, for example, probably would hardly be able to do it many times. And anyway, that's another topic with respect to us, but because these mechanisms are extremely well developed in many animals, insects, birds, mammals, and in us, they're not very well developed. We are basically homebodies. We like to stay, and we do not have the capacities the incredible capacities that some birds have, for example, to migrate thousands of miles. For example, some of the sandpipers that breed up in the north, they fly, you know, many thousands of miles, sometimes nonstop, and they know precisely, you know, they end up at the precisely the right spot. They might have never been there before in the first time. They have mechanisms that we do not have, which is one of the reasons why I think I call it mysterious, because to us, it's very mysterious how some of these bees can do it, how butterflies can do it, how sandpipers, in every almost every single migrating bird in a backyard can do it.
Give us an example of one of the most impressive animal migrators.
Well, the thing is, some of these really impressive capacities are not very accessible to our observation, but I think maybe one of the most impressive and well-studied ones are those of the marbled godwit, the sandpiper, and I mentioned that in the book, which migrates from northwestern Alaska all the way across the Pacific Ocean, flies nonstop to Australia, nonstop across the Pacific Ocean without feeding, of course, without drinking, without stopping for food. I mean, it's almost unimaginable in our human terms, especially since they're so accurate in their navigation. So yes, that would be one of my most impressive. But of course, many, many other sandpipers probably do the same thing. They just haven't been studied. This is very, very difficult to find out, and only with modern technology have we just very recently been able to decipher some of these things.
Yeah. Well, certainly the flying animals are obvious examples of animal migrators. But what about swimming animals like turtles, fish, mm-hmm. whales? How and why do they travel?
Again, a lot has to do with feeding areas and carving areas in the whales. Along the Pacific migrate from the high Arctic down to Baja California to have their pups, calves. So again, it's between different areas that are suitable for rearing the young and for finding food. And turtles as well, too. The whales might do it annually. Some of these turtles come back to beaches where they have been born, and that might be many years later on. And some of the seabirds do the same thing. And we don't really totally understand how they do it, except that we do know that they can sense magnetic lines of force, which we cannot. And this undoubtedly aids them, but how they, again, find the specific spot, we don't know. I mean, we can have a compass, too. We could go in a straight line, but we have to know where we are all the time in order to navigate by it. Unless we go by a straight line, we have to start from a specific spot and go to a specific spot. So there's much more involved than we really have figured out yet in many cases.
We are talking about animal migration and home. We're talking with the author of The Homing Instinct, Meaning and Mystery in Animal Migration. Talking about how almost all species have a pull of home, including humans. And we are welcoming your questions for our guest. We're welcoming any examples you might have, any animal homing instinct that fascinates you. What about you? Do you also have a pull toward home? What questions do you have for our guest? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking with Bern Heinrich, a professor emeritus in the biology department at the University of Vermont, the author of a number of books about biology and nature and ecology and evolution. His most recent book is The Homing Instinct, Meaning and Mystery in Animal Migration. And we're welcoming your questions for him. And we are welcoming your own theories about the homing instinct. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. So animals go to great lengths to defend or gain or even steal territory. Why is this so important to them, Professor Heinrich?
Why is territory important for them?
Yes.
A territory is basically a home. Normally we talk about animal territories. I think I just call it home. It's a place where the advantages are, first of all, that the animal learns where everything is. You know who your neighbors are, you know who your friends are, you know who your enemies are, you know where you find food and how to get there to find it. We might say it's where they get grounded, and you know, it's the same with us. If I were to go into a middle of a city now, I would be totally, totally lost. I had no connection there whatsoever. Here in the territory for a human, for example, you can grow crops or whatever. Basically a territory has to have boundaries. What is yours is yours to keep. What you build is yours to keep. And that's what it's all about.
Yeah, and loons, for example, the beautiful loon that we have on our northern Wisconsin lakes, will go as far as killing other loons in order to acquire their home. I mean, why is their home so important to them? I mean, to kill.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, the home is for rearing young. And the young require lots of food, so they require a safe spot. So mostly, good home territories for loons are where they can build safely a nest. Where the shoreline isn't overrun by raccoons or whatever, or where there's an island where the young can hatch out in safety. And where there are plenty of fish, fish. There's a limit. I don't know. To what extent proximally food is involved in the fighting for the territory, but certainly fish have to be there. If a territory produces young, that means that there is food, that means that there is a safe place to raise them, and so that's very important.
Are there any animals for whom home is meaningless, that they don't have this homing instinct?
Talk about what maybe you call it kind of a surrogate home. Home is where you imprint or are attached to certain stimuli that hold, that are signs that this is a good place. If we take a look at animals who basically do not have a physical home. They do not have a physical home place. They orient to not their specific geological feature and so on. They orient to each other. They're in huge, huge herds. And so they simply follow each other. So their immediate surroundings that they bond to is the herd. And, you know, fish are a good example of that. And I talked about several animals that actually, you know, like passenger pigeons, and they did that. I think they probably didn't even start breeding until they had the presence of others around them, and lots of them. And then there's the examples of the migratory insects in huge herds, such as the locust that went extinct in the Midwest out there. There are animals who are not grounded in the physical realities of the environment.
Got it. We are talking with Bernd Heinrich. He is the author of The Homing Instinct, Meaning and Mystery in Animal Migration. And we're welcoming any questions you might have about the homing instinct of all species, practically, birds, bees, butterflies, other animals, whales, fish, and humans. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Kenneth in Janesville is with us. Hello, Kenneth.
Hello. How about the differentiation between male and female or men and women? Is there a stronger instinct in one or the other?
Do males or females have stronger homing instincts, Professor Heinrich?
Well, it's generally been claimed that males have a better ability to negotiate the spatial environment. But, you know, I personally don't know the real evidence for that. I mean, it's certainly with us, our homing ability, if we were dropped off somewhere, is very, very poor. And we basically go by landmarks, remove the landmarks, and we're pretty much lost. So, you know, it's very possible that especially if you study homing in, let's say, people who are sedentary, people who stay at home, and others who go out and hunt, naturally the men are going to be much more able to follow landmarks. So I'm not convinced that there is much of a difference.
All right, and I apologize. It's Heinrich, Professor Heinrich. And our next caller is Carrie in Harrison. Hi, Carrie.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I just want to ask the professor what he thinks about monarch butterfly migration, the generational migration. I find absolutely fascinating. Also, where are the monarch butterflies, particularly in northern Wisconsin? Haven't seen any the last couple years where we used to see many. And if he thinks that cell phone communication has anything to do with that. And I'll take my question off the air. Thank you.
What can you tell us about the monarch migration?
Well, first of all, I also find it extremely disturbing that I have not seen a single monarch butterfly all last year, and used to see them every year, all kinds of sort of the caterpillars. Every school kid, you know, knew about the caterpillars and the green chrysalis, and they watched the monarchs. And if you go back to the records, 100 or so years ago, they blackened the skies, even down, you know, in the east here to Boston. And so now they have practically disappeared. And the interesting thing is that they only make a one-way migration. and the ones that come back are not the same ones that went down. So they reverse the direction after they get there. But anyway, so it's a very amazing thing. But the reason of their disappearance, at least right now, is apparently spraying for herbicides. But, you know, because milkweeds are basically no longer available for them, and that's in huge, huge, huge agricultural expanses, and they might not have the reproduction anymore.
So, does it help if we plant milkweed in our backyards for the monarchs?
I doubt it. That's just like a pissing against the wind. It's not going to do much at all.
All right. We won't do that then. Let's go to Saul and Stevens Point next. Hello, Saul.
Yeah, hi. In my limited examples of migrations, they're always preceded by flocking behavior or herding behavior, and then the whole flock kind of migrates. I'm wondering, are there any solo migrators?
Oh, many, yes. Yeah, I mean, in fact, I would say most of them. I mean, the monarchs migrate solo. They don't follow anyone else. I mean, actually, the ones that go in groups are, I think, probably the minority. I mean, there are the ones that have to go in groups, but they are basically some birds such as swans and geese and cranes who learn the migration route from their parents. So they migrate in family groups and they pass it on, as you probably saw in the movie Fly Away Home. So they learn, but most of the songbirds, they migrate solitarily. They've never been before, and they know, you know, they know, quote unquote, maybe not consciously, but they have the urge, the instinct to fly at a certain time in a certain direction, a certain distance, in a certain way. These are all different instincts, and so it's mostly by instincts.
And once in a while, we hear in the news about a bird, for example. This year in Wisconsin, birders are all a-Twitter over the painted bunting, which should not be in Wisconsin. That is in Wisconsin, presumably because he or she got lost somehow. That happens, too, that a migrating bird will just get way off course?
Yes, it happens all the time. Mistakes are always made, which is a lot of times how evolution works. If things change, the outliers then can get lucky and find a new habitat, for example. But yeah, I mean, there are actually examples of birds who, instead of flying east, fly west, so they get turned around. So there's all kinds of variation between individuals. And a matter of fact, in Europe, the black-capped warblers used to all migrate across the Sahara Desert to southern Africa. And the desert is getting bigger and bigger, and so it's getting more and more dangerous, and it's getting warmer and warmer in Britain. And so a few managed to go over there by mistake, and now they have a regular population over in Britain. So there are examples of evolution in action.
That's interesting. So it might have been a mistake, but it it works out in the long run?
Yeah, I mean, this painted bunting probably is not going to reproduce.
Yeah, by itself.
But,
by
itself. But, you know, who knows if it happened to had happened to find there and could have reproduced, and maybe they had the same genetic quirk in their DNA that they would, again, end up there from wherever they were. So there's a lot of variation. They don't all do exactly the same thing.
Roxanne emails, is the salmon of the Pacific Northwest, is it that salmon that takes a five-year migration? Or then she wonders, maybe it's a steelhead. But is there a fish that takes 5 years to migrate home?
I doubt it. I imagine, I mean, some of these fish at least spend at least 5 years out in the ocean. That doesn't mean they're migrating there. They're growing there and feeding there and getting bigger and bigger. And, you know, and then when the right time comes, when they get sexually mature, and they feed, get fattened up, and then they migrate. So so it might be five-year intervals that they migrate, or it might they might migrate only once in your lifetime, in their lifetime. So, but they certainly would not. I mean, maybe she's talking about eels on the east, who are born in the Sargasso Sea, way out in the Atlantic, and who eventually, more or less, almost by random chance, come to the coasts and then swim up the rivers and streams, and then live and fatten up in freshwater, and then eventually, after the adult, go out into the ocean. So there are different patterns. But the migration itself is, I don't think it would take 5 years. No, probably a month or so. I don't know.
We do see the those salmon going through, you know, swimming against the current and jumping up cliffs practically to find their way to spawn. What do we know what's going on there? I mean, how they find their way back to the spawning grounds and why they take the hard way?
Well, there was a very famous Wisconsin person who worked a lot of that out, Hasler, and he and colleagues found out that they basically follow scent trails, and so that when the eggs hatch in a sandy stream somewhere, the little salmon imprint on the specific bouquet of scents from the water, there from the different vegetation, and when they go out to sea, when they come back years later, they remember that scent and swim up that stream. So obviously, they are going to the right place. They're going to the place where they were born, which is the proof that it's a good place. Otherwise, they might end up at a cliff and not reproduce at all.
We are talking about the importance of home in the lives of animals of all kinds, and including humans. We've been talking a lot about the migration of different animals, but we'll also talk about the home itself of many animals, and talk about the importance of home to humans too. What animal home fascinates you? Do you have a pull to go home if you're not living in your home right now? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Our guest is Bernd Heinrich, a professor emeritus in the biology department at the University of Vermont. He is the author of The Homing Instinct, Meaning and Mystery in Animal Migration. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. talking about the homing instinct this hour. Birds and bees have it, so do other animals, including humans, and we are discussing this desire for home, this importance of home that crosses all species. And we are welcoming your questions, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Our guest is a renowned scientist, Bernd Heinrich. He is the author of many books about behavior, biology, ecology, evolution. His most recent book is The Homing Instinct, Meaning and Mystery in Animal Migration. And Paul emails, is there a difference between homing and migration? Should we distinguish between homing and establishing a home territory? I guess he's looking for a definition of all these terms.
Yeah. Well, I mean, homing, I think we usually think of homing as the ability to return to travel in a specific place. If you're displaced, can you find your way back, or can you find your way to can you navigate and migration? So in other words, honeybees, for example, employ homing mechanisms to find their way back to the hive, and they do that, you know, several times a day as they fly back and forth between the food source. Migration, we think of a one-way trip, at least for a while, over very long distances.
Mm-hmm. And while you explore the mysteries of animal migration in the book, you also talk about the physical home itself. Everybody, I guess all animals, build homes. Talk about some that fascinate you the most.
Well, I would say humans. I think I was interested originally, especially from birds, because I think bird nests are just amazing structures. Of course, they're not to live in. They're just to raise a young in. But broadly speaking, they're home too. In fact, there are some birds who use the home that they have the young in to live in as well. I mean, those are communal birds, such as certain sparrows and weaver birds in Africa, and there's one species of parrot. They have these huge structures that they build together, and they are the actually stay survive extreme weather conditions, and there are very few birds that build a home for staying in, except right here in the north. The woodpecker, some woodpeckers will make a hole in the fall to stay on cold nights. So there's an exception. But anyways, with respect to humans, we, looking way, way, way back, we were rather helpless apes, and so we needed a shelter and probably used, the proverbial cliffs, homes, and et cetera, and went from there to building structures, to extending the entrance, to having more and more people, and that led to social behavior and basically started the whole history of human evolution. And of course, we built a fire, which had a big impact. And so this is a very large topic and a very fascinating one. So I think I was mostly interested in human homing in the end.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk more about that. In fact, let's go to Jacob in Burlington. Hello, Jacob.
Hi. For me, coming home as a human has all kinds of emotional weight and baggage and delight as well as grief tied up with it. Do we have any studies or data that says animals feel emotional content with home?
Well, I think animals, for the most part, are ruled by emotions rather than by logic. And certainly it's emotions that drive them. So I would think that there is a huge emotional drive to migrate, for example, that's what drives them on. They get really excited. And, you know, in birds, for example, when they start to migrate in the fall, there's a German word called Zugunruhe, migratory restlessness. They jump around and they're really anxious to take off. So that's those are signs of emotion.
Yeah. Can you talk a little, elaborate maybe a little bit more on our caller was saying that, you know, as a human, he is delighted to go home. He's terrified to go home. You know, it's joy and grief and all these things mixed up. It's, I mean, home means means a lot of things.
Yeah, it means a lot of things, and you know, sometimes there are conflicts, and maybe even with parents sometimes, and relatives, so there's all that baggage potentially there and all the goodness that's there. It is a very emotionally loaded concept of home, and I think that is due to the various different results from being home, and the benefits of it that are shared by many individuals, and so sometimes there are conflicts.
Yeah. So is home for humans where our hearts are, or is home where we grew up?
I think the same thing. I think we can find a home that is not where we grew up. I think home, eventually, I would define almost as where your heart is, at least in the sense that I'm talking about it, where you have to be because of circumstances, and you're settled there. I don't know. I would hardly call that home. I think of home as where you have roots and where you have emotional attachments.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Jerry in Appleton. Hello, Jerry.
Hi. I'm a little congested here, but at any rate, I've read several stories about, you know, dogs that find their way home. One in particular, he was lost in Arizona and found his way back home to Washington State. And actually several stories here in Appleton. We have one about Bing, which, at any rate, I was wondering, how do they do that? I mean, that's a long way.
It sure is.
Yeah. It sure is. I mean, bears, you know, have been removed from where they've been problem bears, and a lot of them have come back and a lot of them not. But usually think it's because of the extraordinary ability to smell home. The example that you mentioned about the dog doesn't make sense in terms of scent. I don't know how common that is. There would potentially be, you know, just, we don't know if you got a ride or if you got a ride, et cetera. I don't know of documented studies of dogs as homing and from what distance and so on. I haven't researched that.
Yeah, and we also hear about cats that they move with their family somewhere else, and the cat doesn't care about the family and the home that they moved to. He goes back to his old house. I've heard that to cats, the territory, the environment is maybe sometimes more important than the other individuals.
Yeah, yeah. so they're not so much attached to the person, they're attached to the home.
Yeah, yeah. The what else? Let me share a comment from Patrick on Facebook. I have been in Madison since 2001, yet all the while my heart feels pulled back to the east side of Milwaukee by the university. It is the region that feels like home to me. I think it is a spiritual thing related to love. A person can be in love with a region. Well, do you think so, Professor Heinrich?
Totally, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, that's what homing is about.
Homing is just being in love homing. with that region.
Yeah, it's the emotional attachment to usually where you've grown up or where you have set roots, and I think that's more or less has biological roots which go back way back into. And I think you might say other animals as well. I wouldn't say that an insect has love, but I think warm-blooded animals do.
Yeah. Well, what? Talk more about your own homing that you talked about at the end of the book, and what home means for humans.
Yeah, I can only talk for myself with regards to humans. Everyone can, as to. The experience. Everyone has different experiences, but I just feel that it's general. In my case, I talked about that. I grew up here in Maine in the woods. I was at home in the woods, and I went to school here, and I have friends here, and I see them. It's just like I met them yesterday, So it's a connection to the people. It's a connection with everything that I have grown to love, so I'm basically bring my cabin in the woods to hang out, and I used to deer hunt with friends and neighbors when I was a kid. And, I'm extending that with my offspring and nephew.
Yeah, it's good. It's good to be home.
Yeah. Yeah, good to be home, yeah.
We have just a minute to go. Is there anything that we can learn from the animal world when it comes to our own homing instinct?
Well, I think we can learn that we have many commonalities with the rest of life, that these are general principles that bind us all together, and that the home relates to so many things that explain so much of our behavior, our aberrations and our loves and our whole biology. I think how we grew to be different from other animals is related to a homing.
Yeah.
So it just gives you a grounding in our world. And
we'll have to leave it there. We are out of time. Thank you so much for being with us. Bernd Heinrich is the author of The Homing Instinct. This is the Ideas Network.